Our Story of Atlantis, written down for the Hermetic Brotherhood, by William Fallon, read by Graham Dunlop. Foreword. It is not necessary for an author in these later days always to be able to say he writes of his own knowledge. This has become a recognized fact. He may write from another's experience, in whose honesty and reliability he has as much and sometimes more confidence than in his own personal sense. This is the case with this little book, treating of a subject of interest to the whole world today. For 6 years, I have had the MSS almost ready for the printer. Now, with the encouragement and helping hand of my dear comrades of the Hermetic Brotherhood, I am bid to let it go forth. May it be a help to the once Atlantean born, wherever they may be. W. P. Fallon, M.D. Chapter 1. Poem, Lost Atlantis. Why is this book written? Authorities pointing to the existence of a former continent and city. Definite assertions of destruction by deluge of an island continent positively declared. Testimony of the whirling straws, the flotsam and jetsam of the day. Concurrent evidence of the existence and influence of these people on our civilization. The Lost Atlantis. Fair Atlantis, peerless country, lulled with the ocean's arms, lying beautiful and shining, far beneath the storm's alarms. Never has a plague come near thee, in thy halls were love and ease. Now above thee, lost Atlantis, roll the ever-restless seas. In those histories, half-tradition, with their mythical thread of gold, we shall find the name and story of thy cities fair and old. Dreaming bard has told in fancy, wandering minstrel sung of thee. Now above thee, lost Atlantis, rolls the ever-restless sea. Every heart has such a country, some Atlantis loved and lost, where upon the gleaming sandbars, once life's fitful ocean tossed. Mighty cities rose in splendor, love was monarch of that clime. Now above that lost Atlantis rolls the restless sea of time. Happy he who, looking backward from a life of larger scope, deems a youthful idle fancy his lost continent of hope, or by light of love and gladness find the present home sublime, glad that over his Atlantis rolls the restless sea of time. Why is this book written is the most pertinent question asked an author at the outset of composition. It is echoed and re-echoed by critic and reader upon its publication. It certainly appears to be a fair question whenever the subjects seem so much out of the route of ordinary information as the present volume. The scattered records of the past within the historical period would apparently yield scarcely enough material to make a short magazine article of any interest, to say nothing of a swelling in size to the dignity of a book. It is now conceded, however, by our wisest scientists that every configuration and corresponding circumstance points to the possibility of the existence of an island continent in the neighborhood, if not directly over the great West Indian archipelago. Just as the whole configuration of the North American continent tells the story of the inland sea that broke through its barriers at the Thousand Islands in the St. Lawrence River, and hurling itself over Niagara Falls, left the habitable valley of the Mississippi as a legacy to man for future settlement. The sacred writings of all nations concur in some declaration and statement of disaster to some portion of the earth, most generally including all. In a late issue of Mind appears an article headed, "A Monument to Atlantis," which says, "A notable discovery of more than ordinary interest for historians, especially those who have had leaning toward antiquities, has lately been made by the well-known archaeologist Augustus Le Plongeon. This discovery should particularly attract the attention of Americans, since it enables them to lay claim to one of the most important monuments of ancient times. The edifice in question is the Pyramid of Xochicalco, standing 5,396 feet above the level of the sea. and situated to the south-southwest of Cuernavaca, 60 miles from the city of Mexico. For more than a century, the pyramid has been occasionally visited by distinguished travelers, including the learned Humboldt, but none succeeded in discovering the purpose for which the monument had been erected, nor in deciphering the mysterious inscriptions on its sides. As far back as 1886, Dr. Le Plongeon published his alphabetic key to the Maya hieroglyphs, comparing this with the ancient Egyptian hieratic alphabet. He has now found that the signs on the pyramid of Xochicalco are both Maya and Egyptian, and a careful study of these decorative inscriptions has made it plain to him that the pyramid was a monumental structure erected to commemorate the submergence and destruction of the great land of Mu, Plato's Atlantis, together with its population of 64 million of human beings about 11,500 years ago. Dr. Le Plongeon, in his remarkable work, Queen Mu and the Egyptian Sphinx, gives four Maya accounts of the same cataclysm. This, then, is the fifth, and in his own opinion, the most important of all the known records in Maya language, of the appalling event that gave rise to the story of a universal deluge that is found in the sacred books of the Jews, the Christians, and the Mohammedans. These records on stone, on sun-dried bricks, on papyrus all tell the same story. The little we know of the Aztecs is also confirmatory of the same fact. Whence come the people of South America with their advanced civilization and traditions of the past? What mighty people built the great cities and temples of the now forest-covered cities of Yucatan and Central America, with their carved glyphs and correspondences to the hieroglyphs of the Valley of the Nile and the East Indian entablatures, and moreover, almost precisely similar styles of architecture to those of Egypt and India? Is it reasonable to suppose there was no common bond of fellowship between all these? The ancient Egyptian ideas have dominated the world down to the present day. Instead of a mummy case, we use a coffin for our dead. The idea is the same. The departed ghost was to be saved the trouble of making a new body, perhaps at short notice at the great day of the resurrection. The Trinity in unity of God, now universally received, was an Egyptian idea, and the same is wrought into the stone tablets which Le Plongeon and his amiable wife have unearthed in the forests of the Mayas and Quiches. If the nation, of which these are but the feeble remnants, had not disappeared by some cataclysmal climax, we must certainly have had some later historical data. As the mind of the present generation is more largely than ever desirous of truth, the idea of astral presentation and perception may not be without its weight, especially as the books of wisdom of the past declare that automatic books of record are kept of all deeds and manifestation upon the earth. It may be asked why those who have entered into the rest of the unseen should be at all concerned in the unfoldment and development of the race, who are ever toiling over the rocky paths of the planet. If the doctrine of reincarnation is true, then would it not be to the interest of the coming egos for all the race of men to be advanced just as far as possible, so that the reincarnated from time to time might receive the highest advantage attainable from their touch with the earth at any particular time? Those who are coming back into the present civilization, if they were of the advanced and cultured classes of Atlantis and the most ancient Egypt, would find more advantages of acquirement through our leisure and experience than when hurled into life amid the horrors and darkness of the Stone Age. From time to time, the material and data obtained as hereinafter described, from which this book is made, has been pressed upon my attention as something that would be of use and interest to all who are seeking to know. I do not doubt the authenticity of my information, nor the statements given as facts by those who were so kind and courteous as to make the writer their mouthpiece in this recollection of the ancient memories. I do not doubt that to many readers will come fleeting glimpses of these scenes, as if they had been part of them. It is a conceded fact there have never been, since the fall of Atlantis, so many reincarnated Atlanteans upon the earth at the same time as now. This accounts for the almost universal demand out of the astral records for the forgotten knowledge of the occult, which they there recorded. This also explains the readiness of the public mind to receive knowledge of the doctrines of mental healing, spiritualism, theosophy, and occultism in all its branches. Ignatius Donnelly finds a supporter of his Atlantis theory in Sir Daniel Wilson, president of the University of Toronto, who declares after a great deal of search that the lost Atlantis was not a myth, but that it was really a part of the continent of America. He accounts for its disappearance from view in a different way, but that is merely incidental. Donnelly's theory was that the land was submerged by some great volcanic upheaval, and that from those who escaped to the continents of Europe and Asia came the tradition of the deluge. Sir Daniel rejects this explanation as being disproved by the fact that there are no traces of such volcanic action, either on the continent or in the ocean bed. He believes that the ancient Egyptians, the most progressive and adventurous people of ancient times, discovered the continent, but that in the decline both of their learning and power, it became lost to view and existed at the time our knowledge of Egypt begins merely as a shadowy tradition. It is his opinion that traces of the Egyptians of those days are to be sought in the ruined cities of Central America, whose origin has never been determined nor even been made the basis of any reasonable theory. Such a discovery would furnish a substantial basis for the legend of the lost Atlantis, and the theory invests those wonderful ruins with a new interest for the antiquarians. The St. Louis Republic said, "Atlantis was a continent supposed to have existed at a very early period in the Atlantic Ocean, over against the Pillars of Hercules, but which was subsequently sunk in a cataclysm of which history gives no record. Plato is the first who gives an account of it, and he is said to have obtained his information from some Egyptian priests with whom he had come in contact. Plato's account says, "Atlantis was a continent larger than Asia and Africa put together, and that at its western extremity were islands which afforded easy passage to a large continent lying still beyond. This last mentioned continent now being supposed to be South America, 9,000 years before the time of Plato, according to the tradition. Atlantis was a powerful, thickly settled country which extended its way over Africa and the major portion of what is now Europe, even to as far as the Tyrrhenian Sea. Further progress of the invasion of the Atlantides was checked by the combined efforts of the Athenians and other Greeks. Shortly after the invaders were driven from the continents of Europe and Africa, a great earthquake shook Atlantis from center to circumference. First, the outlying islands sank, then great areas of the mainland. Waves ran mountain high across hundreds of square miles of what had the day before been fertile fields. Great temples were racked and riven, and the affrighted populace climbed upon the ruins to escape the encroaching waters. On the second day, after a night of terrors which no pen could possibly describe, the earthquake shocks were of greatly increased violence, ending only after the entire continent had been engulfed. There is no page in history or tradition that records a more frightful catastrophe, and nothing would be of more absorbing interest than a work entirely devoted to giving an account on what is known concerning it." To the objector, who urges that the explorers of the world have never discovered any traces of the great city and continent, whose story I have endeavored to give in the following pages, permit me to give a few straws floating on our sea of current literature, which show that the history of past ages may yet be read in the central part of our continent. The recent report that a citizen of the United States has discovered among the mountains of the Mexican state of Sinaloa a long-forgotten city tallies with a curious local tradition of the region. Adjoining the state of Sinaloa on the south is the state of Jalisco, and of this state, Guadalajara is the capital. Living in the mountains of Jalisco, part of the great Sierra Madre or Mother Range that extends through Sinaloa and thence northward, are the unconquered Yaqui, a brown-haired people with light eyes and almost fair complexions. Guadalajara is the only civilized town that these Yaqui visit. And it has been long believed that there the Yaqui fastnesses of the Sierra Madre Range conceal not only rich mines of silver, but as well the lost city of the Aztec race. No one has hitherto pierced the mountain wilderness, because the naked Yaqui have an effective system of passive resistance that has hitherto successfully closed the sole line of approach. The only human beings other than the Yaqui themselves admitted to the mountains of Jalisco are a few renegade Apaches, murderous wretches, vastly more dangerous to would-be explorers than the peaceful but persistent Yaquis. There's no question in the minds of those who have given attention to the subject that the Aztecs are the lineal descendants of the mighty nation who sought to know beyond the law governing the created. Of the unknown city above mentioned, we add another description from a different source. During the frequent visits I have made to Mexico, said a mining engineer of Philadelphia to an Inquirer reporter, I've come in contact with many of the Indian residents there and have heard some very singular stories. One which all the Indians unite in telling is that far in the interior exists an enormous city, never yet visited by white men. It is described as peopled by a race similar to the ancient Aztecs, who are sun worshippers and offer human sacrifices to their deity. The race is said to be in a high state of civilization, and the Indians say that the city is full of huge structures, which are miracles of quaint but beautiful architecture, and are situated on broad paved streets, far surpassing those of the city of Mexico. One Indian, I recollect, assured me that he had seen the city and its inhabitants with his own eyes, but had been afraid of being captured and had fled. Of course, I did not believe him, but all the same, it is not little strange that the accounts of the Mexican Indians relative to the mysterious and magnificent interior city agree perfectly. These are but of many of the allusions and traditions pointing to the fact that somewhere in the Southwest, there is a people who undoubtedly hold a complete historical record of the chain of events from Atlantis in its prime down to the present day. While there is perhaps but a single city inhabited and secluded from the outside world of today as keepers of the ancient wisdom, we yet find ruins of such magnitude as to impress us more strongly with the idea that the people who builded the original structures could not have wholly disappeared from this continent. The following from San Diego, California, we offer in proof, calling attention to the fact that the dragon is a favorite design in the East Indian sculptures. The ruins of a prehistoric city have just been discovered by a party of prospectors from Yuma when on the Colorado desert in search of the Peg Leg mine. The wind had laid bare the walls and the remains of the stone buildings, a distance of 420 feet in length by 260 feet in width. Gigantic pillars, quaintly carved to represent dragons' heads and rattlesnakes, still stood in the sands of the desert, supporting on their tops huge slabs of granite weighing many tons. The frieze ornamentation resembled Egyptian sculptures and exhibited a greater degree of skill than is possessed by the Indian artisans of the present day. Fragments of pottery were found underneath the debris, and together with the crumbled piece of frieze, were brought by one of the party to the city. One of his associates came to San Diego and the others returned to Yuma nearly 2 weeks ago. But the story of their discovery was carefully guarded in the hope that in some way they might profit by it. The discoverers, in company with four others, afterwards went to the desert to explore the ruins. They were driven back by a sandstorm, reaching this city today, but we'll make a careful examination of the ruins in the season when the conditions are favorable for extensive explorations. From the relics exhibited, it is evident that an important archaeological discovery has been made. In connection with the above, there is a peculiarity to be noticed in the occurrence of a sandstorm. It has always been so. A storm or some sudden natural event has warded off all efforts to reach these wonderful remains of the prehistoric or even the existing cities. When men shall be ready to seek them, desiring knowledge and not treasure, there is no doubt the keys for the unlocking of the mysteries of the past. will be given into worthy hands, and what we have herein written will receive ample corroboration. We add still another account of wonderful discovery and proof of the immense population of the old Atlantean kingdom in its prime. This time, it is from the city of Mexico, the center of the modern Atlantean or Aztec civilization. What appears to be the verification of an old Aztec fable of a buried race of cave dwellers and a hidden city in southwestern Mexico is a matter in which the local scientists are interested at present. L.P. Leroyal, a French engineer who has lived long in this republic, has just arrived from the wilds of the southwest and reported that he had discovered in the state of Guerrero a huge natural cave, which he believes to be the greatest in Mexico, if not in the world. He says it is much larger than the famous cavern of Cacahuamipa, situated some distance south of Guernavaca, which has hitherto been supposed to be the largest natural cave in existence in Mexico. Mr. Leroyal, after penetrating a considerable distance into the cave, determined to make a thorough investigation of it, and accordingly, a few days ago, furnished himself with food sufficient for a day, provided himself with lanterns, etc., and set out upon his task all alone. As he went along, he made a thorough plan of the cave, but did not anticipate that this task would be so arduous as it proved. At the first, the bottom of the cave was a gradual slope downward, then changed upward, and after alternated, for the most part, between descents and ascents. Here and there, however, a level bottom of great width was met. The height of the cave varied, as might naturally be expected. In some places it was several hundred feet high. For some distance from the entrance, no trace of human beings was found. Occasionally, magnificent stalactites and stalagmites, the finest Mr. Leroyal had ever seen, were met with. After proceeding for some hours, he came upon what had evidently been an ancient cemetery, as there were at least 400 petrified bodies, together with ancient idols, etc. There was also a fountain of beautiful clear spring water, which was found to be excellent. Some of the tools, as well as two or three skulls, Mr. Leroyal brought away with him, and they are now in this city. The appearance of this charnel house thus lighted up for the first time for hundreds of years was gruesome in the extreme and well calculated to shake the nerves of the explorer. Mr. Leroyal continued his explorations while hour after hour passed. It was not until after he had traveled a distance of at least 21.5 leagues that he thought it time to call a halt and proceed on his return journey. So far as he could see, the distance still to be traversed might be very considerable. The chances for the cave opening out, as the floor seemed to be well trodden by human feet. He retraced his steps as speedily as possible, and after being underground for upward of 24 hours, found himself once more at the entrance of the cave. Mr. Leroyal promised to make further explorations before long. It is expected that a party fully equipped for the exploration of this wonderful cavern of the dead will soon be fitted out under the guidance of the discoverer, and the outcome of the investigations will be awaited with interest. The natives of the locality, as in fact the Indian population in general, in Mexico, believe that at some place near the southwestern coast of Mexico, there exists a great white city with countless treasure which has never been seen by white men, and the approach to which is so intricate and cleverly concealed that a stranger has never entered its solitary precincts. With all the increasing mass of information on the subject, it seems there should be some effort at collection under guidance of what is known about Atlantis the Mighty. To make a beginning and thus call attention in this direction is my answer to the question, why this book is written. Atlantean memories. Out of the dim past, old memories come to me, from where the light in all its glory seemed to be, and the people worshipped near the sun's resplendent rays, and lotus-crowned hailed with joy the festal days. Golden lyres sending forth rich harmonious strains, sounding the keynote which o'er the world still reigned. High above all, the Vestal's song and chanting soars, mingling with the ripples on the wave-washed shores. From the temple floats the bell's melodious chimes, so deep and mellow in that old Atlantean time. Our story. Throughout the ages linger these old memories still and hover round me with no effort of my will. Still in my heart is throbbing with the rhythm of the waves, those slumbering waves which, alas, become our graves. Again I hear the glad hosannas to the sun arise. Isis in the sanctuary is veiled from human eyes, which read no warning in the sky's celestial hue, nor heard it murmured in the ocean calm and blue. Neither listened to the whispering wind so free, telling of the doom fair Atlantis was to see. I'm thankful that the gates of memory ope, that the great angels weave the scattered threads of hope, and clothe us freshly with its robes of snowy white, while on the altars shines again the mystic light. The radiant star which once over Egypt shone glimmers once again with a message all its own. Humble though the temple, the melody is there. The bell's sweet chiming breaks upon the silent air. Amid the incense rising from our sacred shrine, old Atlantean glories round our spirits twine. Chapter 2. Poem, Atlantean Memories. Continued cross-examination of witnesses, human and divine, concerning the facts and evidence of the existence of Atlantis Island and city. Description of mountains, cities, caves, and other evidences of occupation by civilized and enlightened people. Speculations and deductions of the past, present, and future. There is yet a little more of the flotsam and jetsam upon the stormy waves of human unfoldment, which is supplemental to our opening chapter, and must be detailed now or put entirely to one side. From two distinct sources, we give an account of an old Mexican city that has never been entered by the foot of a white man, and which was known to be in existence long before the Spanish conquest. Mr. Juan Alvarez, who had just returned from an exploring expedition in the southwestern part of the Republic, reports that he has found a city which has never been entered by a white man, and which has evidently been in existence for hundreds of years, going back before the time of the conquest of the country by the Spaniards. It is an old Aztec city, and the approaches to it are so guarded by nature that it is an impossibility to reach it if the inhabitants do not want a traveler to get in. The city lies in the almost inaccessible mountains in the extreme southwestern part of the country, and is so far away from civilization that few white men have ever been in the neighborhood. It was by the purest accident that Alvarez became aware that a city was anywhere in the vicinity, and after he found it, all of his endeavors to reach it were unavailing on account of the persistent opposition of the natives. He had been traveling over the mountains in search of an outlet to the Pacific Ocean when he came to the top of an elevated plateau, crossed to the further edge. He had a magnificent view, and while looking over the country, saw what he took to be houses in a far distant valley. A close inspection with a glass convinced him that what he saw was really a collection of houses, and he at once set about reaching the place to see who lived in that part of the country. After days of hard work climbing over hills and mountains and cliffs, he reached a point from which he obtained a good view of the city and saw that it was regularly laid out in streets and was peopled with a race who knew something about civilization. The houses were of stone and were surrounded by yards in which were growing flowers and shrubs. On all sides were evidences of taste shown by the inhabitants, and it was evident that he had found a city which was not known to the outside world. A careful examination of the country showed him that the city was located within a natural amphitheater and was accessible from one side only. He saw that the only means of access was through a long and narrow defile which led into the mountains from the Pacific coast side, and he started to reach the place where he could find this entrance. He made an outline drawing of the city as it appeared to him from the distant mountaintop, and this is all he has to show that there is a city within the heart of the mountains, for which he was never allowed to reach the spot. From this drawing, it is plain that the city has not less than 4,000 inhabitants. The houses are all of stone and are supplied with doors and windows. In the center was a large building, which was undoubtedly the temple of worship, for on its walls could be seen sculptured designs representing the deity. It was in the shape of the ancient teocalli, which are to be found in many parts of this country, and the people could be seen passing in and out of it during all hours of the day. After 10 days' arduous work, Alvarez found himself at the foot of the mountains on the western slope and set about searching for the canyon leading to the city. He had so well marked the lay of the land that he had no difficulty in finding the entrance, but he was met by a band of Indians who refused to let him proceed. They offered him no violence, but insisted that he should return. He told them that he had come over the mountains and did not know how to find his way back. After a consultation, he was told that he would have to remain a while as a prisoner, and two runners were sent into the mountains, who returned in a day with orders from someone in authority, and Alvarez was blindfolded and placed on the back of a mule. He traveled in this condition for 3 days, only having the bandage removed from his eyes at night. On the fourth day, he was told to remove his bandage, and when he did so, he found himself on the borders of the Pacific Ocean. The Indians had gone, leaving him with nothing to guide him back to the place where he had seen the city. This city is described in full in Future Rulers of America, and has been visited by persons in the body who have been permitted so to do. We conclude our extracts with the description of another mighty city, the work of the powerful nation whose capital, located on the great island of Atlantis, exercised its power both east and west, of which we are trying to tell. The American archaeologists who went to the recently discovered city in the Sierra Madre Mountains have returned and tell of another hidden city 5 Spanish leagues north of the first city. The leader of the party, C.W. Pantheon of Philadelphia, says that these cities were evidently twin capitals of a wealthy district long before the Aztecs appeared. The two cities are connected by underground passages hewn out of solid rock, and it was while exploring one of these passages that the second was discovered. It lies in a deep basin of the mountains, with no exit except the underground tunnel. At least none has been found. To that which we have thus drawn from all the accessible sources in the visible, I now desire to add supplementary testimony from the astral records, which I believe to be reliable and worthy of credence. Does not this collated evidence of the similarity in nature and civilization west of the great city, which could not possibly have had commerce with the mother country for centuries, prove conclusively, even to the realistic and scientific mind, a common origin for religious teachings, customs, languages, both oral and written? All the discoveries relative to the subject confirm this conclusion. We are indebted to those who are impelled by an irresistible desire to learn and know, who, in this cause, are willing to expatriate themselves, endure danger, and overcome obstructing difficulties, if they may but, by some chance guidance, bring again to the light of day some of the various records which were left when the sun of the manifested spiritual world went down into the shuddering earth. To the Aryan people, who listen with a willing heart, there is much that can be given concerning this ancient city. It matters little how science and religion shall accept that which is offered, whether in a scientific way or from the unseen as true and of value. Science and religion have never received anything new upon untried lines of thought, until they have been forced to the exception. This is why the priests of all ages are so conservative and have withheld so much more than they should, even on their conservative line of thought. It has never been their rule to hold fast upon that of which they have become possessed, content and satisfied without the trouble and exertion of seeking new fields for themselves, or admitting the possibility of broadening truth for others. All that has been ever learned to distinguish the savage from civilization was known to the wise men of Atlantis. Whenever there has been upon the earth a sufficient number of Atlanteans at one time to control a nation or to form one by themselves, that nation or epoch has always experienced a most wonderful growth. In the days of the last Egyptian splendor, when it was the school to which the Greeks and Romans resorted for instruction, was the last time noted in history of such a reappearance in sufficient numbers to admit of a national control. What they did, we have the pyramids, the Temple of Karnak, and all the mighty ruins of the Nile and the Euphrates in evidence. As soon as the Anglo-Saxon-speaking races were sufficiently developed out of savagery, the Atlanteans commenced reappearing, startling the whole world ever and anon with their great strides toward wisdom and knowledge as they slowly paved the way by conquest and discovery for the settlement and reoccupation of that which belonged to them, and for the utilization of all their old resources under new conditions of added strength and experience. In no other way can we account for the wilting and extermination of the red-skinned usurpers, who had neither claim nor strength to maintain title to that into which they had strayed by accident during the temporary absence of the real owners. Much sympathy has been wasted on the red son of the forest. He has but obeyed the law. Who cannot dominate the resources of the environment must yield title to him who can. How much would our vast storehouses of mineral and agricultural wealth have helped man's unfoldment if they had never been used? The difference between the American Indian and the Anglo-Saxon Atlantean is plain to the dullest intellect. As the city of Atlantis grew, her population was drawn off into colonies, which had deep and abiding influence on the whole of the Western continent, but especially centering along the belt in which Atlantis itself was located. Between the fading away of the last Egyptian civilization and the concealment of the world's records at that time, there is a mysterious gap, which can be accounted for only in one way. When Atlantis was in its prime, there were other units in the world's category of nations which were not so far advanced. If Atlantis had held on in the even tenor of her way, all other nations of the world would have received the light and been uplifted to something near its own standpoint. But when this chance of development was cut off, they groped in comparative darkness. When this class of people incarnated again in force of numbers, such scenes as the conquest of Rome by the Goths and Vandals, the overrunning of Europe by the Huns, and the eruption of the Tartars, times without number occurred. As they disappeared from the mortal vision, we can but recognize their sameness of purpose, and the most pertinent fact that undone duty made all this trouble for the Atlanteans of the far past, their comrades and associates. Have we learned the lesson that no human being is separate from ourselves? A wrong once done must be righted. It is the eternal law of exact justice. As these misbegotten impedimenta to progress, pass out into the unseen, having overborne or put off all heads and towered above their own, intellectually, Atlantean influence revives. Little by little have these fellows of ignorance felt the uplifting of influence of the sons of light, and every generation increases the widening wave of educated and spiritualized people, which must finally include within it every nation, tongue, or people of the earth's full complement of inhabitants. The American nation has done a vast deal for the enlightenment of the whole world. Thus, it is easy to understand why the extinguishing power of all that holds the soul in chains is projected towards us. In the ancient times, when the lamp of civilization burned at Rome and Athens, or later, as at Antioch and other cities, single centers of learning blazed out and lessened the darkness, as do beacon lights on the hill. But with these, compare the events of today, a compact, unified nationality, which resembles the old Atlantis, had its beginning on an island, cut off from easy approach. Yet it has been able to make its power felt throughout the whole world. Although the English name be detested, its power is always respected. Not only has this nation made itself felt everywhere, but it is the founder of the American nation and unites its force with that to push the common civilization and thought currents into every part of the globe. The freedom of the thought body and the aptitude of the minds engendered thereby has once more drawn to the American continent more Atlanteans than were ever incarnated at one time since the fall of that city. It thus happens that their inventions and knowledge and wisdom and the results of thought force modified and perfected by the assimilation of hundreds of years in devachanic rest, is coming upon the nation in a flood, as with outstretched hands they demand from the silence that which they themselves deposited in the astral records long ages since. We often wonder at events transpiring in the way of discoveries, or at the applications of principles which are perfectly logical and linked one upon another. We have surely reached a point and begun to guess about the uses and methods of the application of that vehicle of force, about which the Atlanteans knew much, and desiring to know more, found there was a limit which barred their further progress. We already have hold upon another, and we desire only that they who may essay to advance in this direction may do so with body, soul, and mind so purified they will not need the reprimand of obstruction that came to the original investigators of our nation on that line. The reason why this age is so celebrated above others of the near past is due to the facts thus stated. We perceive in the near future, as has been repeatedly foretold, the end of a cycle is at hand. Cataclysmic results, the sinking of land in some places, and the rising in others, is imminent. When cities peculiarly situated are crowded with inhabitants who have lost all conception of everything but their own desires centering in selfish purpose, their thought vibrations become inharmonious with the universal thought vibrations. If this inharmony continues strong enough to communicate itself to the ground upon which the city stands, the foundation being subject also to a set of vibrations upon the natural plane of liquidity, serious consequences may occur. Just what the outcome of the present period will be, none but the Council of the Seven Great Builders know. But this we have gathered, that within 100 years, and possibly a much shorter time, Atlantis will be above the waves, whatever her monuments contain, or whatever may be in a ruined temple, can then be investigated. Within 500 years, the bulk of population will be south of the equator. That which is now sea will become dry land, and the old continent of Lemuria will once more sustain its millions of inhabitants. Scientists tell us that the time is fixed when all the gold, silver, and coal will be mined. How short-sighted. Under the sea is 1,000-fold more than has ever been brought to light by man's busy hands. Chapter 3. Beginning of a Voyage. The Attractive Stranger. Acquaintance ripens rapidly. Such a face as children love and scoundrels hate. An eloquent and instructive talker. Atlantean memories seem to the new friend, personal experiences. The wonderful cities of the past that have disappeared, the little black lettered manuscript in a strange language, history of Atlantis. Your desire for information on these lines will be gratified. In the early 70s, having by constant and severe attention to business reached a point when rest and change were imperative, I was advised by my physician to take a sea voyage. I mentioned this fact to a friend of mine in New York City, who was a vessel owner. He offered me the position of supercargo in one of his vessels about to sail for San Francisco, around the Horn. I gladly accepted the chance, for it gave me both motive and occupation for the trip. My preparations were made rapidly. We sailed out of New York Harbor on the 15th of June, 1872. As the last lighthouse sank slowly beneath the waves and the full moon rose in the heavens, I stood watching the receding landmarks, little dreaming of the momentous events to happen as part of the voyage, nor of the marvelous revealings to come to my knowledge before I should again touch my foot upon land. Of all these, the following pages are but a feeble portrayal. But it is always so in life. We meet and part, come and go. The consequence of the meeting and the pain of the parting may be inexpressible in spoken language. But how shall we know? Who will tell or warn us of the swiftly oncoming future with its burden of weal or woe? As our vessel was devoted to freight, we, as I knew, carried but a single passenger, who by a special favor of the owner had been permitted to occupy the one spare cabin. The rest of the space was occupied by the officers of the ship, including myself. I had been introduced to this man when he first came on board, but being much pre-concerned about the business I had in hand at the moment, I had simply responded with the usual meaningless phrase of, "Happy to make your acquaintance." But I remembered afterwards an impression of dignity, of bearing, sweetness, of real courtesy on his part, and that peculiar, indescribable thrill as we shook hands, which once or twice in a lifetime it may be our good fortune to experience, as the lines of our lives cross with those who are essential to our highest and best unfolding. Standing thus, leaning meditatively over the taffrail, I came back to myself by hearing my name pronounced distinctly in a low musical voice with just the slightest foreign accent. Looking around, I acknowledged the address, as he went on to say, "I see you are leaving part of yourself behind you." "Oh, not a large part," I replied, but I was thinking about the certainty of parting and the uncertainty of meeting. "Don't you think that we part forever from our friends, only when we have accomplished or finished all that we can do for each other? So long as our work remains undone, we shall certainly meet again." "Yes," I said, "that may be so, but it is the human uncertainty that saddens." Looking full at this man, to whom, with his every word, I was most indescribably attracted, I saw a picture, from that time indelibly stamped upon my memory. Tall and almost perfectly proportioned, eyes black, while in their ordinary kind expression one might easily imagine their possibilities, when honest indignation or righteous anger stirred their depths. Hair and beard white and worn a little longer than custom prescribed, his bearing was majestic in strength, serene in harmony, attractive beyond compare in its unselfish desire for the good of others. With all this, there was an impression in all he said. He could tell very much more, if he only would, about any subject concerning which he might be conversing. It was such a face as children love and scoundrels hate, containing within itself the pitying tenderness of a mother's love and a father's sustaining watchfulness. In our interview, I passed from the outermost border of casual acquaintance to the confident championship of sworn friendship. At this, too, I marveled, for I am slow to receive or offer friendship, but come slowly to the perception of what might be in those who honor me with their goodwill. Although we stood some little time longer gazing upon the ocean, as the night and waters met in closer and still closer embrace, we lapsed into silence with that strange feeling of being company for each other. Although no word was said, and finally we descended to our respective cabins for the night. As is usual with the position which I held, my duties during the voyage were almost nominal, making up for this leisure, however, during the receiving or discharging of the cargo or any part. Consequently, I had sufficient time to improve the acquaintance so curiously begun. It did not take long to find out that my friend was a zealous, unremitting student, and that while we were familiar with many lines of common interest, there were others in which he was well versed, of which I knew comparatively nothing. He was a very eloquent and instructive talker, and readily and gladly answered my questions. Especially was this true of things in the past, which the present generation has moved on and forgotten. And a peculiarity of his descriptions was that they were given as if personal experiences of his own. Later, I knew why, but at the first it seemed that it was done to give more life and movement to the story. As a child, I had always been fascinated with whatever I had chanced upon, either in reading or conversation which related to Atlantis. But as I grew older, enveloped in the materialistic ideas of the modern schools, I had come to regard the little that was known of that ancient mistress of the seas as largely fabulous, if not wholly unworthy of credence. After we had been out from port 4 or 5 days, as we sat chatting on the quarterdeck, something was said which induced me to ask him the question squarely. "Do you believe there ever was such a country as Atlantis?" "Most certainly," was his quiet, decisive answer. But you do not think it possible that a whole continent could disappear so utterly beneath the waves as that is said to have done, leaving no more trace of its former existence than has been the case with that. And why does this seem impossible to you? Does history know anything of the city that stood under ancient Troy? Who knows who were the builders of that, or what the design of the pyramids of Egypt? Who can tell of the cities lying strata upon strata in the valley of the Nile? In your own country, who can tell anything of the mound builders? What does the world know of Palmyra, of Babylon, or of the great cities in the valley of the Euphrates? But for the accessibility of the ruins, they would by this time have been as thoroughly forgotten as Atlantis now is. And, here his face softened with an infinite pity, perhaps within 40 years from now we may have another lesson in the opportunity for denying the existence of the past. But maybe, he continued, you would like to hear some of the actual records brought down even to your day of an event that concerns so intimately every living person now upon our planet. Upon my eager assent, he went into his cabin and soon returned with a small black letter volume, written after the style of the Far East, upon parchment from right to left. Opening it, he read in his sweetly modulated tones, translating as he read the following extract. Facing the Pillar of Hercules was an island larger than Africa and Europe put together. Beside this main island, there were many others, smaller ones, so that it was easy to cross from one to another as far as the further continent. This land was indeed a continent, and the sea was the real ocean in comparison to which the sea of the Greeks was but a bay with narrow mouth. At the Atlantic island, a powerful federation of kings was formed, who subdued the larger island itself and many of the smaller islands, and also parts of the further continent. They also reduced Africa within the straits as far as Egypt, and Europe as far as Tyrrhenia. Farther aggression, however, was stopped by the heroic action of the then inhabitants of Attica, who, taking the lead of the oppressed states, finally secured liberty to all who dwelt within the Pillars of Hercules. Subsequently, both races were destroyed by mighty cataclysms, which brought destruction in a single day and night. The natural features of the Attic land were entirely changed, and the Atlantic island sank bodily beneath the waves. In the center of the Atlantic island was a fair and beautiful plain. In the center of this plain, and nearly 6 miles from its confines, was a low range of hills. Here dwelt, for many generations, the renowned race of Atlan, from whom the whole island and sea were named Atlantic or Atlantis. The ruling kings ever handed down the succession of power to their eldest sons, the youngest sons going into the priesthood. They were possessed of such wealth as no dynasty ever yet obtained or will easily procure hereafter. This wealth was drawn both from all foreign nations with whom the Atlanteans traded and from Atlantis itself, which was especially rich in minerals and possessed the only known mines of ore chalcum in the world. A mineral with most wonderful and inexhaustible properties, a metal which was then second only to gold in its value. The country was rich also in timber and pasturage. Moreover, there were vast numbers of elephants, spices, gums, and odorous plants of every description, flowers, fruit trees, and vegetables of all kinds, and many other luxurious products, which this wonderful continent, owing to its beneficent climate, brought forth. These were sacred, beautiful, curious, and infinite in number, nor were the inhabitants content with simply the natural advantages of their glorious country, but also displayed a marvelous industry and skill in engineering and the constructive arts. For in the center of the island they built a royal palace, every succeeding king trying to surpass his predecessor in adorning and adding to the building, so that it struck all beholders with the greatest admiration. They cut about the royal palace a series of waterways or canals. These were bridged over at intervals, while an immense canal admitted the largest vessels from the sea, giving at once protection as a harbor and making it more convenient for the transportation of freight to and from the interior. In fashioning their interior streams, they left docks cut out of the solid rock where their triremes could land their cargoes. The stone used in their building was of three colors, white, black, and red, so that many of the buildings presented a gay appearance. Their walls were covered with brass, which they used like plaster, tin, and orichalcum, which had a glittering appearance. Northeast of the center of the continent stood the great temple. The interior was covered with silver, except the pediments and pinnacles, which were lined with gold. Within the roof was a magnificent mosaic of gold, ivory, and orichalcum, and all walls, pillars, and pavements were covered with orichalcum. By a system of aqueducts leading from natural springs of hot and cold water, they had supplies for baths and for the irrigation of their beautiful plantations and gardens. The docks were filled with shipping and naval stores of every description known to men at that time. The whole city teemed with a dense population. The main canal and largest harbor were crowded with merchant shipping, returned from or making ready to sail for all parts of the world. The din and tumult of their commerce continued all day long, and the night through as well. Such is a general sketch of their wonderful city. Now, as regards the rest of the country, it was very mountainous, with exceedingly precipitous coasts, and the plain surrounding the city was itself environed by a mountain chain, broken only at the sea entrance. The plain was smooth and level and of an oblong shape, lying north and south. The mountains were said to be the grandest in the world for their number, size, and beauty. The whole country was a constant succession of prosperous and wealthy villages, for there was an abundance of rivers and lakes, meadows and pasturage, for all kinds of cattle and quantities of timber. They surrounded this plain with an enormous canal or dike, 101 feet deep, 606 feet broad, and 1,250 miles in length. By it, the water from the mountains was conducted around the whole plain, and while a part flowed out to the sea, the rest was husbanded for irrigation. They were able, by raising two crops a year, to double their productive capacity. In the polity of the Atlanteans, the kings maintained an autocracy, and the priesthood were their council of consultation in all matters of state, until at last the power passed into the hands of the priesthood. For many generations, the rulers, king, and priest remained obedient to their ancestral traditions, for they possessed true and altogether lofty ideas and exercised mildness and practical wisdom, both in the ordinary vicissitudes of life and in their mutual relations. They looked above everything except virtue. They considered things present of small importance and contentedly bore their weight of riches as a burden. Nor were they intoxicated with luxury, but clearly perceived that wealth and possessions are increased by mutual friendship and the practice of true virtue, whereas by a too anxious pursuit of riches the possessions themselves are corrupted and friendship also perishes therewith. Thus it was they reached the great height of prosperity we have described. But when, at the last, their mortal natures began seeking to dominate and override the divine within and about them, they commenced to display unbecoming conduct and to degenerate, thus blighting and finally destroying the fairest of the most valuable possessions. This, said my friend, is an authentic account as that of any nation of whom we have any history, for it was handed down from father to son in the ancient Atlantean writing, which was perfected about 25,000 years before the Christian era commenced. Just then, some duty claimed my immediate attention, and as he rose up to return to his cabin, he looked me fully in the face and remarked, "If I mistake not, the time is close at hand when your desire for information on these lines will be more fully gratified." Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.